Now, I know this sounds like a rainstorm, but it's actually Percy Grainger performing Molly on the Shore. This is recorded in 1920. Let's have a little listen. It's something miraculous to me that that's actually Percy Grainger playing in 1920. And it's a vinyl record. I'm holding it in my hand. It's got a picture of Percy looking down at the piano, looking all very artistic with his long wavy hair. And it's one of the vinyl records that our favourite ABC sound librarians have uncovered this week, all of them centred on musicians or bands who courted controversy or scandal. Michael Munson and James Lee, welcome back.
Good morning. Good
morning, Michael.
Okay, so Percy Grainger. Why Percy Grainger?
Well, one of our great national treasures as an Australian composer and performer, of course, he's enormously respected, enormously famous, but also he's one of the great eccentrics of not only kind of our country, but just one of the great eccentrics. And anyone who's gone to the Percy Grainger Museum will have been introduced to his collection of whips and all sorts of kind of strange things.
Strange clothing that he made.
Yeah, the Terry Towelings and stuff like that.
Well, as you say, let's just explain what the Percy Grainger Museum is, because it's one of the undiscovered or unknown treasures of Australia. It's in Melbourne. It's on the grounds of the University of Melbourne, easily accessible. Ought to be a major tourist attraction in Melbourne.
Agreed.
Can't understand why it isn't, because he's a major figure. Mm. You know, when you arrive in a city, if you've got to go to Leipzig or you go to Munich or you go to Beijing, the tourist industry sort of tells you what to do.
That's true.
You know, you get to Leipzig and they say Bach's house is here. Mm. You say, oh, is it? Oh, well, Mendelssohn's house is here. Oh, well,
exactly.
off I go.
And you go to Salzburg.
It always suffered, that museum, and it was refurbished and done up a few years ago, and I think it's doing all right now.
Well, there's always been, you know, people who've opposed it at the University of Melbourne who've eyed off that real estate and wanted it for something
else.
But
it is actually a beautiful, it's a very interesting museum, and I don't know if you've been there recently.
Many times.
It's fascinating, and it's a fascinating guy that they're, you know, is on show there, and his life is kind of, you know, he was into so many things.
Like, well, into random music, apart from, you know, taking traditional tunes like this one, Molly on the Shore, famously, English Country Garden, in an English country. Yeah. He did a piano arrangement of that. He didn't write it, but he wrote the arrangement.
And he did a lot of recording of folk music, and, you know, he was an ethnomusicologist, he was into everything.
But the other end, Michael, he also did sort of random music. So there are these big drums that...
The kangaroo pouch machine.
And they rotate. I mean, I don't think they work anymore, but they rotate in such a way that strings are tightened and loosened. Yeah,
and it's kind of part of an idea of expressing a kind of randomness about music. Yeah. And he devoted the last part of his life to that, you know, to inventing these machines that would play what he called free music.
But there ought to be, you know, he's a magnificent topic for a big film documentary.
Yeah.
Absolutely,
Imagine an APC that was making, you know, films like this.
He appears in that Ken Russell, what's that famous Delius film, Ken Russell, as a funny little character
in there.
Yeah, mischievous kind of Granger. Yeah. But, you know, in his life, he was fascinated by many things, and there was one major scandal with his mother that popped up in, and you know, his mother ended up taking her or jumping out of a window of his manager's office in New York.
This is Rose.
Rose. Which is never found, like never proven or.
The implication was what, Michael?
Well, that there was an incestuous relationship between Rose and Percy.
Mm. And she was quite fearful that the letters that she had exchanged with Percy would eventually become public. And the letters are incredibly passionate and could be very easily viewed by anyone reading them as, you know, evidence of a incestuous relationship.
Right. All of Percy's, fun stuff ended up in a big envelope.
His sexual paraphernalia.
Yeah. And that was to be released, I think it was 10 years or more after his death, because then he thought everyone else would be gone.
Yeah. But that's important to understand. I mean, this is not a scandal about Percy Grainger. He wanted people to know had this risky sexual side to him. And he actually thought that only very special people who had a powerful artistic temperament could take these kind of sexual risks. The rest of us were sort of condemned to more conventional exploits. More, but he liked to go
missionary
out on the edge. Yes, he was not. He was an atheist. Yeah. He was no missionary.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're looking at scandals that have affected people's lives. You know, Percy was deeply affected by his mother's death, of course, and. You know, have you seen the display at the museum of he kept the handbag of his mother the day she died?
Oh.
And the contents and all of that are on display there.
Oh, so, I missed that.
Yeah.
You know, when I first went to that museum, which was in about 1975, I knocked at the door.
No one home.
And it said opening hours and a little card by the door, and the door opened. And a person peered me when I said, yes. I said, I'd like to see the museum, please. They said, what? I said, isn't this a museum for Percy Grainger? Yes, said the person. Well, could I come in and look? Oh, I suppose. Then they put the lights on.
You took your life in your own hands.
Yep.
And the lights flickered on. They really didn't want you in there.
No,
back in the day, they didn't want you in there.
Right, okay.
No, it was a ramshackle old bits and pieces everywhere.
Mm. All right.
Anyway, let's
move on.
Let's move on to Eugene Goossens.
Sir Eugene, I do
apologise. Sir Eugene Goossens, again, another national treasure, an Australian composer.
He was English, actually.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Right, okay. But he was an Australian citizen, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. He spent 9 years here teaching and conducting the Symphony Orchestra
in Sydney, famous as a conductor. In fact, the hall at the ABC in Ultimo in Sydney there is named after him.
Yeah,
it's Eugene Goossens Hall. So, I mean, this is a brilliant man, and this is a terribly sad story.
Yeah,
his life was impacted by. Should we just hear him conducting?
Yeah, let's do it.
And then
this is his work.
Oh, this is his own work. Okay.
Great.
Oh, yeah, he's magnificent.
He was an incredible composer.
I didn't appreciate this about him. I knew he was a conductor, but I actually didn't know this, that he was a composer. So this is called The Apocalypse.
The Apocalypse,
what do we know about this piece?
Well, it was written in the 50s, early 50s, and, around about the time that he got hauled up at the customs with a bag full of porn, and which pretty much ended his career.
Yeah, but, well, that's the scandal. And
that is scandal.
You know, tragically, that's, I mean, I suppose we're perpetuating it by talking about it today, but
no, I don't,
that's what he's remembered for.
Yeah. No, I think we can turn it around. I mean, we're thinking about, well, how would it be today, you know, if you showed up at Tullamarine with a bag full of porn, you'd probably be okay, wouldn't
you? Well, it's not illegal. Yeah. I mean, you know, there are kinds of porn that are illegal.
So we're talking about Australia in the 50s, you know, it's extremely conservative.
Yeah.
He had a strong career in Australia, which was just over, and it was he went back to England pretty much straight after this.
That's right, and he just could not return to Australia. He was kind of shunned and kind of sent away, never to work in Australia again.
I mean,
and
he is.
So
he's like Percy Grainger in a way, because he does did have interests in
exactly.
sexual adventures.
Well, he had a interest in, I think it was the occult as
the
well.
Occult, he was mixed up with a person called the Witch of King's Cross.
Well, that wouldn't have helped.
No, Rosaline Norton, right. who went under the name of Thorne, was a devotee of Pan, and would engage in all sorts of occultist activity, and Goossens was very interested in that. She was embroiled in some sort of court case, and Goossens' association with her led to an investigation of Goossens, and that's why he was kind of... That's why he was caught at Sydney Airport.
They worship the god Pan. Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. The Witch of King's Cross did.
Sounds kind of fun.
Actually. Yeah, I know.
Well, he would have had a ball. He would have been having a great time in the 50s, but of course Australia was such a conservative place back then that he was targeted as a
I'm so glad you brought that in. So that was performed... When was that performance done? It was
in the 80s.
In the 80s, and it was the first
by the Sydney Symph.
Right. So that's a recording that you brought in. This is recording 10/714 from the ABC's record collection. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and you're enjoying our regular segment, which we call The Vinyl Frontier, in which we look at some of the LPs from the ABC's wonderful collection of LP records. James Lee and Michael Munson helped the nation care for this wonderful heritage here at the ABC, the overfunded ABC. What else are we...
Let's just have a quick little listen to a guy called Frank Farian, who's a German. This is a German song, sung in German. The English translation is called "Is I Love You Just the Way You Are."
Ich liebe dich, so wie du bist. Ich bin so froh, wenn du nur bei mir bist. Was auch geschieht, ich hab dich lieb. Ich sage dir, wie es ist. Ich liebe dich, so wie du bist. Ich bin so froh, wenn du nur bei mir bist. Was auch geschieht, ich hab dich lieb. Ich sage dir, wie es ist.
Frank Farian. Ich liebe dich so wie du bist. It's punchy.
Yes, well done, it is.
It's punchy, isn't it? And it's certainly an upbeat and very, very quirky but number.
Hidden mastermind.
But why are we listening to Frank Farian?
Why
because he is the brains. He was the brains behind Milli Vanilli. Yeah. So now look, he also was the brains behind Boney M as well. And the Boney M and Milli Vanilli stories are very similar.
So Boney M was a disco sort of pop group in the 70s.
Yeah. And everyone would kind of know Daddy Cool and
Rasputin.
And they had massive hits and were huge in the 70s. But on those Boney M recordings, it's actually Frank Farian singing. Yeah. So when we hear that kind of deep voice in those Boney M tracks that the guy in Boney M would mime in film clips and live performances, it's actually Frank Farian singing.
Right.
And the same goes for Milli Vanilli, although it's not Frank Farian singing.
Well, let's hear Milli Vanilli, and then we'll remember why that was a scandal.
Yeah.
Wow, let me see you dance. Wow, let me see you dance.
So I remember Milli Vanilli. Milli Vanilli were two absurdly beautiful young men.
I mean,
just gorgeous with sort of long ringlets. And one of them had these sort of alabaster eyes. And the other one had dark, sexy bedroom eyes. And they could move like gods.
Yeah.
But there was a scandal.
There was a massive scandal. And looking back on it now, again, the scandal seems quite kind of quaint. But the crux of the scandal is that the record company did deliberately mislead a record buying public into believing that these vocals were sung by the two guys we see here on the front cover.
It wasn't
cover.
The two gorgeous guys singing.
It was a guy called Charles Shaw, among other vocalists, but the lead vocals were done by a very kind of obscure, up until that point, American singer called Charles Shaw. Again, Frank Farian kind of pulling the strings in a Machiavellian type sort of way, just orchestrating all this. And once they were exposed as a fraud, all hell broke loose.
And it was terribly sad.
It was sad.
It was sad because it ends in quite tragic circumstances when they try to mount a comeback themselves, which fails miserably, and then one of them dies as a drug overdose.
It's all Frank's doing too, because he signed them up. They could sing too. They were a singing act, and them up, and then had this album already ready to go with this. And he said, "Oh no, sorry, you're just going to mime it."
When it happened, I was surprised that it was a scandal because I thought this probably happens all the time, doesn't it? You get someone with a good voice and someone else who's gorgeous and you put them together. Everything's sort of fabricated and even people who can't sing sort of can sing better because they've been electronically mixed and their voice is corrected.
It's showbiz.
Yeah, that's showbiz. And it's an awfully grey area once you start getting into the extent to which a lot of vocals these days are electronically manipulated.
Yeah.
You can listen to a Cher track, for instance, and it just doesn't sound like a human anyway. So back then, I was surprised as well. I thought, well, who cares, you know? The problem is when the albums are credited with
absolutely.
You know, so
we've got to stop. Thank you so much for coming back and taking us beyond the vinyl frontier.
Always a pleasure.
Always a joy. James Lee and Michael Munson, two of our ABC sound librarians.